Another soldier approached and saluted with a fist to his heart. He cast a wary glance at Ulick and Egan, who were standing with their arms folded while he waited silently.
"Nothing, Lord Rawl," he said when Richard acknowledged him. "Not so much as a flake of rock that's been worked with tools."
"Keep looking. Try the outer fringes of the boulder field. Look for places where you can crawl down under some of the larger boulders and check under there, too." The soldiers saluted and hurried off. There wasn't much of the day left. Richard had told them that he didn't want to stay the next day. He wanted to get back to Aidendrill. Colin would probably be back that night, or possibly tomorrow. He wanted to be there. If she came back. If she was still alive. He broke out in a sweat at the very thought. His knees felt weak. He banished the thought. She would be back. That was all there was to it. She would be back. He made himself quit thinking about it and put his mind to the problem at hand.
"So what do you think, Lieutenant?"
Lieutenant Crawford pitched a stone, watching it bounce first off one boulder and then another. The sharp sound echoed off the cliff behind them.
"It could be that the face of this mountain broke off much longer ago. Then, over all that time, things started growing in, dying, making soil for larger things to grow, and then they died, making yet more soil. It could be that it's been covered over."
Richard knew what Lieutenant Crawford was talking about. He knew how a forest, in time, could cover over rock slides. If you dug in the forest at the bottom of a cliff, you often encountered the bones of the fallen mountain.
"I don't think so, in this case."
The lieutenant looked over at him.
"May I ask why you think not, Lord Rawl?"
Richard stared across the rift to the next mountain.
"Well, look at that cliff. The face of it is rough and uneven, yet the rock of the mountain left behind after the face fell away is weathered now. So much of it isn't sharp. It's been worn by time. Some of it is sharp, though. Water gets in the cracks, freezes, and breaks off more of the rock with time. You can see some of those sharp places, but most of it has a softer look. It has the look to me that it happened long before this slide here, yet you can still see most of the rock lying at the bottom of the cliff. Here there's much less scree."
Egan unfolded his arms and brushed back his blonde hair.
"Could just be the lay of the land. This cliff faces south, letting the sun in to help things grow, whereas that one faces north, so it's in shade most of the time. The forest wouldn't grow in as well over there, and that would leave the scree exposed."
Egan had a point.
There's more to it."
Richard tilted his head back and looked up the thousands of feet of sheer cliff face towering above them. "Half this mountain is gone. That one over there is just a small slide in comparison. Look up at this mountain and try to imagine what it would have looked like before this happened. It's cleaved from the very top all the way down like a log round split in half. All the rest of the mountains around here are more or less cone-shaped. This one is only half a cone. Even if I'm wrong, and half the mountain isn't gone, and it used to be shaped much as we see it now, there would still be an immense amount of rock down here. I mean, even if it used to be much this shape, and only a shell of rock 10 or 20 feet thick collapsed, by the towering height alone there would have to be a huge pile of rubble. This rock is sharp, so it might be pieces broken off by the working of water freezing, but probably, since I can't see any time-worn places, it happened more recently. I just don't see any evidence of the mass of rock that would have had to come off this mountain. Even if it had been covered over in time, I think that where we're standing would be a huge mound." The lieutenant glanced about.
"You have a point. This is pretty much level with the bottom of the rift. If all that rock broke off, there's no mound under the forest down here."
Richard watched the soldiers all about, searching through the rock and woods for any sign of the Temple of the Winds. None looked to be finding anything.
"I can't see that it's down here. I just don't see any reason to believe that the mountain fell down here."
Ulick and Egan folded their arms again. The matter settled as far as they were concerned. Lieutenant Crawford cleared his throat.
"Lord Rawl, if the half of Mount Kimmermost that used to be there isn't down here, then where is it?"
Richard shared a long look with the man.
"That's what I'd like to know. If it isn't down here, then it must be someplace else."
The blonde-headed lieutenant shifted his weight to his other foot.
"Well, it didn't just get up and walk away, Lord Rawl."
Richard turned his scabbard out of the way as he started climbing down off the rocks. He realized he was frightening the man. Richard seemed to be suggesting something that hinted at magic.
It must be as you say, Lieutenant. It must have fallen and grown over. Perhaps the cleft between the mountains was deeper back then, and the fall simply filled it in, rather than making a mound.
The lieutenant liked the idea. It gave him a rock-solid reality. Richard didn't believe it. The cliff face looked peculiar to him. It was too smooth, as if cleaved with a huge sword. Yes, there were jagged places, but that would explain the rock that was at the bottom. It looked to him as though the mountain had been cut off and taken away, and over time water and ice had worked at the smooth face of the cliff, breaking off pieces and making it more craggy, but it was nowhere near as rough as the other cliffs round about.
That might explain it, Lord Rawl. If that's true, though, that would mean that the temple you're looking for must be buried deep underground.
With his two huge guards right at his heels, Richard made for the horses.
I want to have a look up on top. I want to see the ruins up there.
Their guide, a middle-aged man named Andy Millett, was waiting with the horses. He wore simple wool clothes of browns and greens, much like Richard used to wear. His shaggy brown hair hung past his ears. Andy was immensely proud that Lord Rawl had asked him to guide them to Mount Kimmermost. Richard felt a bit sheepish about that. Andy was simply the first person Richard found who knew where it was.
Andy, I'd like to go up to the ruins on top.
Andy handed Richard the reins to the big roan.
Sure enough, Lord Rawl. There's not much up there, but I'd be glad to show you just the same.
Big as his two guards were, they mounted lightly, their horses hardly moving under the sudden weight. Richard swung up into the saddle and wiggled his right boot into the stirrup.
Can we get up there before dark? Most of that spring snowstorm has melted. The trail should be open.
Andy glanced at the sun, which was just about touching a mountain.
With the way you ride, Lord Rawl, I'd say long before. Usually important people slow me down. I think I'm the one slowing you down.
Richard smiled. He remembered the same thing himself. The more important the person he guided, the slower they went, it seemed. The sky was streaked with golds and reds by the time they reached the ruins. The surrounding mountains were cast in deep shadow. The ruins seemed to glow in the honeyed light. There were some once elegant structures, now crumbling, that looked to have been part of a larger place, just as Colin had said. Here and there on the barren mountaintop, parts of walls still stood, their stones not covered by vine and wood, as they would have been down below, but covered with a rust of lichens instead. Richard dismounted and handed his reins to Lieutenant Crawford. The building to the left of the broad road was large by any standards Richard had grown up with, but compared to castles and palaces he had seen since, it was an insignificant structure. The doorways stood empty. Crumbling evidence of a door frame remained, still partly covered with gold leaf. Inside, the walls echoed with his footsteps. A stone bench sat in one room of the roofless building. In another room, a stone fountain held snow melt. A twisting hall with most of its barrel ceiling still in place led Richard past a warren of rooms. The hall split, leading, he surmised, to rooms at either corner of the building. He followed the left branch to the room at the end. Like all the rooms on this side, it faced the cliff. Hollow rectangles gaped where windows once shielded the room from wind and rain. Beyond, through the openings, was a view past the edge of the cliff to the blue haze of the mountains beyond. This was the place where visitors and supplicants to the temple would have awaited admittance. During their wait, they would have had a glorious view of the Temple of the Winds. If they were turned away, they left with at least that much. He could almost see what those who had stood in this very spot had seen. It was his gift, he knew, that was telling him this, much the way the spirits of those who once held the Sword of Truth guided him when he used that magic. As he stood staring, he could almost imagine it there, just beyond the edge, a place of grandeur and might. This was where the wizards had taken things of powerful magic for safekeeping. The wizards of old, some of them Richard's ancestors, had probably stood where he stood, looking out at the Temple of the Winds. Richard strolled around outside in the fading light, past the stately columns, peering into guard huts and once magnificent garden structures, touching the deteriorating walls. Even though it all was now crumbling, it was easy for him to imagine the majestic scene it must once have been. He stood in the center of the broad road that ran through the crumbling ruins, feeling his gold cloak billowing out behind in the wind, trying to visualize the place as it had been, trying to get the feel of it. The road, more than the buildings, gave him the eerie feeling of the presence of the temple beyond. This road had once led right into the temple of the winds. He strode the wide roadway, imagining striding toward the temple of the winds that had said they were hunting him. He passed along part of a wall, and between the hollow stone buildings, feeling the timeless quality of the place, feeling the life that once was here. But where had it gone? How was he to find it? Where else could he look? It had been here, and even now Richard could almost see it, feel it, sense it, as if his gift were pulling him onward, pulling him home. Abruptly, he was jerked to a halt. Ulick, on one side of him and Egan on the other, had seized him under his arms and pulled him back. He looked down and saw that another step would have taken him out into thin air. Vultures soared in the updraft not 20 feet straight in front of him. He felt as if he was standing at the edge of the world. The view was dizzying. The hair on the back of his neck stiffened. More should lie beyond the edge at his feet. He knew it should, but there was nothing there. The temple of the winds was gone. Chapter 43.
Breathe.
Talon did as she was told, expelling the sliff and pulling in the sharp, cold air. The sound of a hissing torch roared in her ears. Her own breath echoed painfully. But she knew what to expect by now and calmly waited for the world around her to twist back to normal. Except this was not normal. At least, it was not the normal she expected.
Sliff, where are we?
Her voice reverberated around her.
Where you wished to travel, the Jacopo treasure. You should be pleased, but if you are not, I will try again.
No, it isn't that I'm not pleased. It's just that this wasn't what I expected.
She was in a cave. The torch wasn't the familiar kind she was accustomed to, a length of wood with pitch at the head, but instead was made of bundled reeds. The ceiling nearly brushed her head as she swung her legs down from the sliff's well and stood. Colin pulled the bundled reed torch from where it was wedged in a split in the rough stone wall.
I'll be back, she told the sliff. I'll have a look around, and if I don't find a way out, I'll come back and we'll go somewhere else.
She realized that there must be a way out, or the torch wouldn't have been there.
Or else, when I'm through finding what I'm looking for, I'll be back.
I will be ready when you wish to travel. We will travel again. You will be pleased.
Colin nodded to the silver face reflecting the dancing torchlight, then stepped into the cave. There was only one way out of the room she was in, a wide, low passageway, so she went through it, following it as it twisted and turned through the dark brown rock. There were no other corridors or rooms, so she kept going. The passageway led to a broad room, perhaps 50 or 60 feet across, and she found out why this place was called the Jacopo Treasure. Torchlight reflected back in thousands of golden sparkles. The room was filled with gold. Some were stacked in crude ingots or spheres, as if the molten metal had been poured into pots, the pots then broken away. Simple boxes were piled high with nuggets. Other boxes, with handles at both ends so they could be carried by two men, held a rubble of golden objects. There were several tables still holding gold discs and shelves along one wall. The shelves held several gold statues, but were filled mostly with rolled vellum scrolls. Colin wasn't interested in the Jacopo treasure. She didn't take time to inspect the objects all around and, instead, made for the corridor on the other side of the room. She didn't want to linger in the room because she was worried and wanted to get to the mud people. But even if she had been interested in looking around, she wouldn't have stayed long. The air smelled awful,
and made her gag and cough. The foul stench made her head spin and start to hurt. The air in the passageway was better, though not what she would call good. She reached over and felt the bone knife and found it still warm. At least it wasn't hot, as it had been. The tunnel began slanting upward as it twisted along. As she went higher, the dark rock became dirt, in places held back with beams. She didn't see any other passages branching off until she began to smell fresh air. One tunnel branched left, and in a few paces another right. She felt cool air drifting down from the one straight ahead, and so went that way. The flame of the torch whipped and fluttered as she stepped out into the night. The sky glittered with stars. A figure not far away sprang up. Colin backed a few paces into the cave, glancing both ways to see if there was anyone else waiting outside.
"Mother Confessor,"
came a voice she knew. Colin took a step forward and held out the torch into the night air.
"Chandalin? Chandalin, is it you?"
The muscular figure rushed into the torchlight. He had no shirt and was smeared with mud. Grass bundles were tied to his arms and head. His straight black hair was slicked down with the sticky mud the hunters used. Even though his face was also smeared with mud, she recognized the familiar wide grin.
"Chandalin," she said with a sigh of relief. "Oh, Chandalin, I'm so happy to see you."
"And I you, Mother Confessor."
He advanced toward her to slap her face in the traditional mud people greeting to show respect for another's strength. Colin held her hands out, warding him.
"No, stay away."
He straightened to a halt.
"Why?"
"Because there was sickness where I came from, in Aidenville. I don't want to get too close to any of you, for fear I might pass the fever on to you and our people."
The mud people were indeed her people. She and Richard had been named mud people by the Birdman and the other elders, and were now members of the village even though they lived apart. Chandalin's pleasure at seeing her faded.
"There is sickness here too, Mother Confessor."
Colin's torch lowered.
"What?"
she whispered.
"Much has happened. Our people are afraid and I cannot protect them. We called the gathering. Grandfather's spirit came to us. He said that there was much trouble. He said we must speak with you and that he would send you a message to come to us."
"The knife," she said. "I felt his call through the knife. I came right away."
"Yes. Just before dawn he told us this. One of the elders came out of the spirit house and said I was to come to this place to wait for you. How did you come to us from the hole in the ground?"
"It's a long story. It was magic. Chandalin, I don't have the time to wait until we can call another gathering to speak with the ancestor spirits. There's trouble. I can't afford to wait 3 days."
He lifted the torch from her hand. His face was grim under the mud mask.
"There is no need to wait 3 days. Grandfather waits for you in the spirit house."
Colin's eyes widened. She knew that a gathering lasted only through the one night it was called.
"How can that be?"
"The elders still sit in the circle. Grandfather told them to wait for you. He too waits."
"How many are sick?"
Chandalin held all his fingers up once, and then only one hand the second time.
"They have great pain in their heads. They empty their stomachs even though they have nothing in them. They burn with fever. Some begin to turn black on their fingers and toes."
"Dear spirits," she whispered to herself. "Have any died?"
"One child died this day, just before Grandfather sent me here. He was the first to become sick."
Colin herself felt sick. Her head spun as she tried to come to grips with what she was hearing. The mud people didn't usually tolerate other people coming to their village, and they rarely ventured from their lands. How could this have happened?
"Chandalin, have any outsiders come?"
He shook his head.
"We would not allow it. Outsiders bring trouble."
He seemed to reconsider.
"One may have tried to come, but we would not allow her to come to the village."
"Her?"
Yes. Some of the children were playing at hunting out in the grassland. A woman came to them, asking if she could come to the village. The children ran back to tell us. When I took my hunters to the place, we could not find her. We told the children that their spirit ancestors would be angry if they played such tricks again.
Cullen feared to ask, because she feared the answer. The child who died today, he was one of those children who said they saw the woman, wasn't he?
Chandalin cocked his head.
You are a wise woman, Mother Confessor.
No, I'm a frightened woman, Chandalin. A woman came to Adendrill and talked to children. They have begun to die, too. Did the boy who died say that she showed him a book?
When I went on my journey with you, you showed me these things called books that you use to pass on knowledge. But the children here do not know of such things. We teach our children with living words as our ancestors taught us. The boy did say that this woman showed him pretty colored lights. That does not sound like the books I remember.
Colin put a hand to Chandalin's arm, a touch that once would have frightened him with the implied threat of a confessor's power, but now worried him for other reasons.
You said we should not be close.
It doesn't matter now, she reassured him. I can cause no further harm. The same sickness is here that is in Adendrill.
I am sorry, Mother Confessor, that this sickness and death should visit your home, too.
They embraced in friendship and shared fear.
Chandalin, what is this place, this cave?
I told you of it once, the place with the bad air and the worthless metal.
Then we're north of your home?
North, and some west.
How long will it take us to get back to the village?
He gave his own chest a thump with a fist.
Chandalin is strong and runs fast. I left our village as the sun was going down. It takes Chandalin only a couple hours, even in the dark.
She surveyed the moonlit grassland beyond the low, rocky hill on which they stood.
There is enough moon to see our way.
Cullen managed a small smile. And you ought to know that I am as strong as you, Chandalin. Chandalin returned the smile. It was a wonderful sight to see, even under the circumstances.
Yes, I remember well your strength, Mother Confessor. We will run then.
The moonlight conveyed intimately the ghostly, boxy shapes of the Mud People's village lying hidden on the dark, grass-covered plain. Few lights burned in the small windows. At this late hour, not many people were out, and Colin was glad for that. She didn't want to see the faces of these people, see the fear and sorrow in their eyes, and know that many of them would die. Chandalin took her directly to the spirit house, among the communal buildings at the north side of the village. Most of these buildings were bunched close together, but the spirit house sat apart. Moonlight reflected off the tile roof Richard had helped to make. Guards, Chandalin's hunters, ringed the windowless building. Outside the door, on a low bench, sat the fatherly figure of the Birdman. His silver hair hanging down around his shoulders shone in the moonlight. He was naked. Black and white mud covered his body and face in a tangle of whorls and lines, a mask all in the gathering war so the spirits could see them. Two pots, one with white mud and the other holding black, sat on the ground at the Birdman's feet. She could tell by the glazed look in his eyes that he was in a trance, and speaking would do her no good. She knew what was required. Colin unbuckled her belt.
Chandalin, would you mind turning your back, please, and ask your men to do the same?
It was the greatest concession to her modesty that circumstances would allow. Chandalin called out the order to his men in his own language.
My men and I will guard the spirit house while you and the elders are inside, Chandalin said to her over his shoulder.
When she had slipped off all her clothes and at last stood naked in the cool night air, the silent Birdman began applying the gooey mud so that the spirits might see her, too. Sleepy chickens sat watching from the nearby low wall. The wall still bore a slash from Richard's sword.
She knew she had to do this, to go in and speak with the spirits, but she wasn't eager. Speaking with the spirit ancestors was only done in times of dire need, and while the results sometimes brought the answers needed, they never brought joy.
When the Birdman had finished covering Colin with the white mud, he silently led her inside. The six elders sat in a circle around the skulls of ancestors arranged in the center. The Birdman took his place, sitting cross-legged on the floor. Colin sat in the circle opposite him, to the right of her friend, Savidlin. She didn't speak to him. He, too, was in a trance, seeing the spirit in the center of the circle that she could not yet see. A woven basket sat behind her. Knowing why it was there, she picked it up and resigned. Hesitantly, she seized a squirming red spirit frog and pressed its back between her breasts, the one place she wasn't painted. The slime from the frog tingled against her skin. She released the spirit frog and took up hands with the elders to either side. It wasn't long before she felt herself spiraling into a daze. The room began its dizzying spin. She was lifted away from the world she knew and carried into a revolving vortex of light, shadow, aroma, and sound. The skulls spun with her. Time twisted, much as it did in the Slif, but not in the same comforting way. This was a disorienting experience that brought sweat to her brow. It also brought the spirit. His glowing form was before her, yet she couldn't recall when it had appeared to her. It was simply there.
Grandfather,
she whispered in the tongue of the mud people. Chandalin had said that it was his grandfather who had come in the gathering, but she recognized him on a more visceral level. He had become her protector. She felt the connection to the bone that had been his in life.
Child.
The unearthly sound of his voice coming through the Birdman tingled against her flesh.
Thank you for heeding my call.
What does our ancestor's spirit wish of me?
The Birdman's mouth moved with the spirit's voice.
That which has been partly entrusted to us has been violated.
Entrusted to you? What was entrusted to you?
The Temple of the Winds.
Colin's naked flesh prickled with goosebumps. Entrusted to the spirits. The implications made her head swim. The spirit world was the underworld, the world of the dead. How could something like a temple, built mostly of inert materials like stone, be sent to the underworld?
The Temple of the Winds is in the spirit world?
The Temple of the Winds exists partly in the world of the dead and partly in the world of life. It exists in both places, both worlds at once.
Both places, both worlds at once? How could such a thing be possible?
The glowing form, like a shadow made of light, lifted a hand.
Is a tree a creature of the soil, like the worms, or is it a creature of the air, like the birds?
Colin would have preferred a simple answer, but she knew better than to argue with the dead.
Honored grandfather, I guess the tree is of neither world yet exists in both.
The spirit seemed to smile.
So it does, child,
the spirit said through the Birdman.
As does the Temple of the Winds.
Colin leaned forward.
You mean the Temple of the Winds is like the tree with its roots in this world and its branches in your world?
It exists in both our worlds.
In this world? In the world of life,
where it always was, on the mountain of the four winds. You know it as Mount Kimmermost.
Mount Kimmermost,
Colin repeated in a flat tone.
I'm a grandfather. I have been to that place. The Temple of the Winds is no longer there. It's gone.
You must find it.
Find it? It looks to have been there at one time,
But the rock of the mountain where the temple used to be has collapsed. The temple is gone, except for a few of its outbuildings. There is nothing to find. I'm sorry, honored grandfather, but in our world, the roots have died and crumbled.
The spirit stood silently. Colin feared it might become angry.
Child,
the spirit said, but not through the birdman. The voice came from the spirit itself. The sound was so painful it was almost more than she could bear. She felt as if the flesh would burn from her bones.
Something was stolen from the winds and taken to your world. You must help Richard, or all my blood in your world, all our people, will die.
Colin swallowed. How could something be stolen from the spirit world, the world of the dead, and be brought back to the world of the living?
Can you help me? Can you tell me anything that might help me to know how to find the Temple of the Winds?
I have not called you here to tell you how to find the winds. The way of the winds will come with the moon. I have called you here to see the extent of what has been released and what come of your world should this be allowed to stand.
Grandfather's spirit spread his arms. Soft light cascaded from them like water coming over a ledge. The light spread in her vision until she saw only white light. The light cleared, and she saw death. Corpses, like leaves littering the ground in the autumn, lay everywhere. They were strewn in the street where they fell. They sat on steps, slumped against railings. They lay in doorways and on dead carts. Colin's vision was carried through windows as if on the wings of a bird. Bodies lay rotting in homes. She saw them in beds, in chairs, in halls, stretched out on floors and slumped over one another. The stench gagged her. With her floating vision, Colin swept to towns and cities she knew, and everywhere it was the same. Death had taken nearly everyone, their bodies black and rotting even before they had died. The few still living, wherever she viewed, wept in unrelieved anguish. Her floating vision returned to the mud people's village. She saw the corpses of people she knew. Beside dead cook fires lay dead mothers holding dead children in their arms. Dead husbands held dead wives. Here and there, orphaned children with tear-stained faces wailed hysterically beside the corpses of parents. Everywhere, the stench was so thick it made her eyes water. Colin gasped back a sob as she closed her eyes. It did no good. The sight of the dead burned through to the vision in her mind.
This, the spirit said, is what will come to pass if that stolen from the winds isn't halted.
What can I do?
Colin whispered through the tears.
The winds have been violated. That which was entrusted was taken. The winds have decided that you are the path of the price. I have come to show you the results of this violation and to beg you, on behalf of my living descendants, to fulfill your part when you are asked.
And what is the price?
I have not been shown the price, but I forewarn you that I do know that there is no way for you to circumvent or avoid it. It must be as it will be revealed to you, or all will be lost. I ask that when the winds show you the path, you take it, lest what I have shown you comes to be.
Colin, tears streaming down her cheeks, didn't have to consider.
I will, Grandfather.
Thank you, child. There is one other thing I will tell you. In our world, where the souls of those departed from your world now reside, there are those existing in the light with the Creator, and those who are forever shadowed from His glory by the Keeper.
You mean that there are both good and evil spirits in this?
That is an oversimplification that nearly obscures the truth, but it is as near as you, in your world, would be able to come to comprehending this world. In this, our world, all make it what it is. The winds must allow all to mark out the path.
Can you tell me how the magic was stolen from the winds?
The path was betrayal.
Betrayal? Who did they betray?
The Keeper.
Colin's jaw dropped. She immediately thought of the Sister of the Dark who had been in Adendrill, Sister Amelia. It had to be her.
The Sister of the Dark has betrayed her master?
This soul's path was to enter the Temple of the Winds through the Hall of the Betrayer. That is the only way to achieve the initial breach. It was created as a precaution. To tread the Hall of the Betrayer, a person must betray completely and irrecoverably that in which they believe. Since they have irreparably betrayed their cause, they would no longer have reason to enter. The Dreamwalker found a prophecy that could be used to defeat his foe, but to ignite it, he needed magic from the winds. The Dreamwalker found a way to force this soul to betray her master, the Keeper, yet still carry out the Dreamwalker's wishes. He did this by at first allowing her to maintain her oath to the Keeper, and by relegating himself to the role of her secondary master, her master in your world alone. Then, with the use of a double bind, he forced her to betray her primary master. She was able to tread Betrayer's Hall with her charge from the Dreamwalker and her obligation to it intact. In this way, the Dreamwalker violated the winds and obtained what he wanted. Those who sent the temple into the winds did, however, make contingency plans should such a thing happen. The Red Moon was the ignition of these plans.
The very word betray had made Colin's heart pound.
Is this the way we must gain entrance to the winds?
The spirit considered her as if weighing her soul.
Once the Temple of the Winds has been violated, that path is closed, and another must be used. But this is not your concern. The winds will issue their requirements in conjunction with the precepts of balance. The five spirits guarding the winds will dictate the path accordingly.
Honored Grandfather, how can a place issue instructions? You make it seem as if the winds are alive.
I no longer exist in the world of life, yet when called, I can pass information through the veil.
Colin's head hurt from trying to understand. She wished Richard were here to ask questions. She feared to miss the important one.
But, honored Grandfather, you can do this because you are a spirit. You lived once. You have a soul.
The spirit began fading.
The boundary, the veil, was damaged by this event in the winds. I can remain no longer. The Skryn, the guardians of the boundary between worlds, pull me back. Because the violation in the winds altered the balance, we cannot return again in a gathering unless the balance is restored.
The spirit faded until she could hardly see it.
Grandfather, I must know more. Is the plague itself magic?
The voice came from a great distance.
The magic sent into the winds is of vast power. To use it fully requires vast knowledge. It was used without understanding what was released or how to control it. The plague was begun by this magic, much as a bolt of lightning from a wizard is magic. But if the lightning strikes a tinder grassland, the resulting firestorm is not magic. The plague is like this. It was begun with magic, but it is now simply a plague.
as others before, random and unpredictable, yet heeded by magic.
The plague is in Aidendrill and here. Will it stay confined?
No.
Jagang didn't realize what he had done. This could end up killing him, too, if allowed to burn out of control.
Is it, as you showed me, already in other places? Has it already been started in those other places, too?
The light of the spirit extinguished like the weak flame of a lamp gone out.
Yes.
Came the distant, echoing whisper. They had hoped that they would confine the plague to Aidendrill. That was hope lost. The whole of the Midlands, the whole of the New World, was about to be consumed in the firestorm started by that spark of magic from the Temple of the Winds. In the center of the circle, where the spirit had been, the air swirled as the spirit vanished back into the underworld. In the distance, in the underworld, Colin heard the soft echo of laughter from a different spirit. The malevolent chuckle made her skin crawl.
This is the end of side one. There is no need to change your balance control. Simply reverse this cassette. That is, turn to side two and continue listening.